Today we're going to have our special event. It's called the Black Panther Speak Against Political Repression. As many of you know, the era of the 60s and 70s brought about a lot of social change and radicalization in society. And one of the major and most prominent forces throughout this era was the Black Panther Party, who instilled a sense of power and empowerment and struggle into the minority, the working class, the black, and the underprivileged communities. Not only did they inspire a whole generation of activists into fighting for struggle, but they also brought about crucial questions about racism and the nature of our society. As you all know, the Black Panther Party and many other progressive organizations of the time were attacked continuously by the U.S. government through the FBI and its whole Intel program, and basically were seen as a threat when they started to talk about problems that affected the structure of this oppressive society of the day, and that to some extent is still out there today. Many of these fighters from the Black Panther Party, many other organizations, ended up being incarcerated as political prisoners, and to this day are still locked up behind bars. So today we're going to have some speakers that have been themselves at some point political prisoners, and all have always been advocates and fighters against political imprisonment. So basically, what we want to get out of this meeting is that, you know, we believe that it's very urgent that we re-energize the fight against political oppression in this society, which today is still prominent in the sense that there's things like the U.S. Patriot Act, like the death penalty. There's laws like the Rockefeller drug laws and the three strikes laws in California. And there's over 2 million people in prison, and over 50% are black people. We're going to have our speakers today talk about their experiences and talk about how we can better the fight. So first, I'm going to introduce Henry Shasha Brown, a former member of the Black Liberation Army and also at some point a political prisoner. He's going to tell us all about his struggles.
My name is Henry Brown, Shasha Malik Olabala. I'm a resident of Brooklyn, through North Carolina and Virginia. I came here to tell y'all I love you, and I hope you do what we did. We were young just like you. We were ambitious. We were philosophical. We ran the whole gamut. I came from a street gang in Brooklyn called the DeKalb Chaplains. I got politicized when I went to prison. That's how I got the name Shasha, which means king of king or ruler. Some of you, the older generation, know it as the Shah of Iran, who was dethroned. But anyway, my development came through when I was incarcerated. That gave me the chance to view things in a different perspective. Being young, I was wild. I mean, like, tomorrow is not a given. And most people say, well, it is, but I didn't care if it was. That's the stage I was at. When I heard about the black perspective, what we were about, what happened to us, what's really happening, I became a nationalist. And from that point, I developed into a humanitarian, realizing that racism was something that was a part of the United States, and that if the mothers and fathers of the next generation didn't allow them to be humanitarians, then they would become racists. This was the program in the United States, and this is what we have to combat. And the younger generations, which are all of you, is what you have to do. Because the older generations, we did what we had to do, and we're here to tell you tonight that you have to continue. The youth is what makes history after the older generation. Every generation makes some type of history. Every generation leaves their imprint in what happened. And we have to leave here tonight with the concept of making an imprint. We have to walk across the sand and leave our footprints in history. Now, but what we got to remember is a continuous struggle, a continuous struggle. That's why each generation has to do something and leave their imprint. It could be positive or negative. It's up to you. With myself, I hope and pray that whatever I do is positive and will contribute to the next generation. Because one of the things that is being said is that those before us didn't do anything. I don't want to be put in that context. I want you to remember that I was before you, but I did something, or tried to do something, and made an impact, a positive impact, on those that came after me. Because we have enough negativity around us already. If we didn't, we wouldn't be here. So we got to realize, since this is what it is, how are we going to change it? What are we going to do? Are we going to be more receptive or reject what the past generation did? No, you don't. You take from them and move on. Now, if you want to hear my prison experience, listen to this. I had never been arrested in my life. I was in the 11th grade. I was a good student. I got arrested for something, got locked up my first time. My co-defendant was totally innocent. He was as innocent as all of you. They gave him 5 years. I told them he wasn't a part of it. You know what they told me? Oh, you just saying that to help him. And this man was totally innocent. And they gave him the same amount of time that they gave me. That's when I learned that sometimes when you tell the truth, they don't believe you. But if I went up there and said, yeah, he was with me. Matter of fact, ask me, I'll testify against him. They'd have went for that. You know, they would have jumped on that with all 2 feet. But when I told them that he was totally innocent, that he wasn't the man, which he wasn't, with me, I mean, they rejected that, you know. It made what I was saying about imprint, you know, an imprint on me. And we went to jail, did our time, so on and so on. That's when I, you know, did my reading, realized what was happening. Can I ask a question? How many students here? Just raise your hand. The first successful revolution in the Western Hemisphere. What country?
Haiti.
Let me see your hands. Whoa, that's all? Out of all of you? All right.
A black country.
Tell me the name of the president there, the one that fought the revolution. What was his lieutenant? Dessalines.
Right.
Who built the fortress that was impregnable in Haiti? Henry Christopher. Who won the revolution? What individual? Who won it? Henry Christopher, Dessalines, or Toussaint? Who won it?
Dessalines.
Why?
Because they captured Toussaint and take him to France and kill him in the mountains.
Thank you. Very well spoken. And you are from the older generation. I appreciate that. And you are correct. Then Dessalines took over. And he made the completion. But everybody credited the successful revolution to Toussaint. And that's why I always loved the unsung heroes. Because that's what he was. Unsung hero. He's the one that put, as we say, the icing on the cake. Another question for you. Who made this famous quote? People could think they could be an eagle and don't have a feather on their back.
Well, you pointed at me.
No, I'm just saying.
I'm not you.
Who made that quote? Fidel was making a speech. And they asked him the question, oh, what do you think about so-and-so? And so he said, oh, they think they're eagle and don't have a feather on their back. But if you think like an eagle, you can have feathers and nobody has to see it. But they will see it in your action and the way you fly. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next up we're gonna have Mr. Thomas Blood McCreary, who is a section leader of the Black Panther Party in Brooklyn back in the late 60s.
Thank you. My name is Thomas Blood McCreary, and former member of the Black Panther Party. I'm a former Vietnam veteran. I am also a former merchant seaman. I came of birth during what they call the baby boomers, so between 1940 and 1945. And in this country, I'm trying to give you a backdrop in terms of where my politicization comes from, that sort of thing. My need to struggle, why I felt it was important to struggle. And I happen to have been fortunate enough to live through a period in history that comes every 1,000 years, and that is the decade of the 1960s. I'm a product of that period in time. And in terms of the history of this country, that was a period in time where we most likely were in a position to have had the second American Revolution. However, we fell short of that. And what brought this attempt at revolution about was in terms of social, economic, and political situation of the United States. in terms of people of color or minorities. I come out of a period in time in Brooklyn between the 1950s and 1960s when in New York City, gangs were the dominant socialization of groups of people and individuals and whatnot. In coming out of that period in history, and some of you should be able to understand the other motivating factors in my life to put me on the path that I eventually ended up on. The 1960s was a period in time in this country where oppression was rampant, while so many forms of destructive things that was taking place in this country that could have destroyed us as individuals and whatnot, and also as a collective of people. These are some of the motivation factors that propelled me into becoming involved in the social revolution of that time in an attempt to change the United States. As I stated earlier, I came out of a gang period in time. I'm talking to you this way because I'm considering the age factor in terms of the people I'm talking to here. You know, that always plays a point in time in terms of what we know and where we come from and how we perceive history. During this period in time that I was coming of age, gangs was very prevalent in this city in terms of black people in places like Bedford-Stuyvesant and Harlem, Brownsville, East New York, South Bronx and whatnot. The youth of that period in time had about two or three ways they could go in life. You know, life, the future was very bleak for many of us. You either went to the penitentiary, you ended up doing long times in prison, you were murdered. That was the setting of the situation, you know, during the 60s and coming out of the 50s, late 50s and early 60s and whatnot. Police brutality within our communities was at an all-time high. We had 15 and 14-year-old kids being thrown off rooftops when the cops caught them. There was a lot of murder. Not too many blocks from here, you know, there was an incident that took place after school one afternoon with some kids between the ages of 13 and 17, where they were murdered on the streets, and we set off one of the Harlem riots. You know, it was a fruit stand incident, you know, kids being rambunctious and whatnot, you know, some fruit got overturned and they used that as a pretext to have an assault against the black community. After that incident occurred in my life, from where I'm coming from, that was some motivating factors and whatnot. You know, as I stated earlier, this gang activity had sort of influenced my way of thinking in terms of a way out of the situation that I was faced with and many others that came out of my community was faced with, you know. So some of us ended up going into the military. And going into the military, we had no clue and no idea what we were getting off into, you know. I'm gonna give my age away here. I entered into the United States Army on the day that they were burying John F. Kennedy. That was 1963, November 27th. At that time, there was a place called Vietnam. Most of us didn't even know how to spell the word. It did not exist and whatnot, you know. But after entering into the military in 1963, by the time, 2 years later, we had became very much aware of Vietnam and had been introduced to Vietnam. I ended up doing a 13-month tour of duty over there. I was 18 or 19 years old at this period in time and whatnot. I'm also talking about a period in time for a historical backdrop when Ole Miss, some of you read that in your studies here, you know, in terms of history, Mississippi was being integrated by an individual by the name of James Meredith, a black who had recently came out of the military, enrolled in Ole Miss on the GI Bill to go to school, you know. There were a lot of other civil rights activities taking place during this period in time, but these are some of the highlights. After entering into the military in New York City, I ended up being shipped not too far from where all this was taking place, at a place called Columbus, Georgia, where Fort Benning is located. And I'm giving you this bit of history to let you know how close 150 miles away some serious activities taking place in terms of your people in this country and whatnot. Now, this is right after Birmingham, you know, the dogs when you see on the news, all this was taking place and whatnot. To round the story off, and we can get off into some questions and answers when we all have that period in time here. Coming out of the military, racism being what it was, going to Vietnam, into a situation in the United States that was unbelievable. I mean, this was indescribable. It was almost like Vietnam was being transplanted into the United States, especially during the summer months and whatnot, you know. We had the same thing with what's happening in Iraq in terms of the National Guards being sent instead of Iraq. Baghdad, they were being sent into Bedford-Stuyvesant, and they were being sent into Harlem, South Bronx and whatnot, and Cleveland, Detroit, you know, and all parts of the United States in its major cities. coming back into a situation after coming out of a situation like that, but it was much more deadly in the Nam. The same tactics that they were using in Vietnam, they started using in the black community in the United States. Helicopters was introduced for the first time to law enforcement. They started using helicopters, and they got that idea from Vietnam in terms of how we track people over there and kill people over there. So they were doing the same things. And in the Black Panther Party, when you study the history of the Black Panther Party, you would find out there was a lot of military veterans from the Vietnam War within the Black Panther Party. Some of them became leadership, such as Geronimo Pratt. You had people like Landon Williams, out of the 82nd Airborne, out of
Eddie Griffin Conway,
exactly. Many of them had been into the military, so the skills that we had learned into the military, we had to transport back to the United States because of the time. What was happening here with these kids being, as I stated earlier, being murdered into the streets and whatnot. Also during this period in time, the Black Panther Party had been formulated. And it was in its first developmental stages between 1966 and 1968 at a period of time which I came back from Vietnam. And as I said earlier, the civil rights movement was in full tilt in the United States. You had young black organizations like SNCC, and you had young white progressive SDS and the Weather Underground and many other socialist organizations of that period in time and whatnot. People were involved. They had no alternative but to become involved. You know, I mean, the way the country was situated at that period in time. Coming back from overseas and coming back to the United States, especially back in the Brooklyn, Bedford-Stuyvesant during this period in time, and the civil rights movement had blossomed in the South and other parts of the United States. It had become no longer a Southern phenomenon. Throughout the United States, there was activities taking place in terms of black people and other people of color, you know, gaining their rights. It's not just people of color. You know, we had a women's liberation movement was in its developmental stages. You also had the gay liberation movement. They were coming into their own and whatnot. So, and yet this age group I see in here, a lot of you have read things about the hippies and the yuppies. Many of them was very progressive people. All that history is not necessarily correct the way they presented and whatnot, you know. They don't necessarily dwell on the seriousness of those individuals in terms of how they were moving in this country because life was precarious. Putting it mildly during that period in time. The Black Panther Party started in California and it came to New York City in 1968. And in fact, New York was the second city outside of California to have organized the Black Panther Party. First city and state was Seattle, Washington, then New York and elsewhere in the United States. The need for such an organization came about because of that period in history which I stated to you earlier in terms of cops murdering kids in the streets and whatnot. The economic system of people of color was very bad. Some of the same symptoms that we talk about today in terms of summer youth employment, daycare, other forms of social needs that wasn't being addressed and whatnot. And then you had an element in this country, the oppressor, who was living very high, you know, in terms of the standards of the country. And at that time, the United States was in a position for many people to have lived that way, a very comfortable life without the turmoil that we had. That was happening in our lives, and which was brought about because of economic situation, you know, and racism. As I said, 66 was the formation of the Black Panther Party in California. In 1968, it came to New York City. And when it came to New York City, we had just came out of a riot, and we were faced with a lot of things that that many people was faced with around the United States in terms of oppression within our community. And speaking to some young people today, you know, when I tell them about this period in history, they don't seem to understand what it was like for young people to have been in a situation like that. Like you young people out here, you would have been forced to become involved. You know, conditions was not such that you had the luxury of being as individualistic as some aspects of youth have become today in terms of their social activism. And you have the same ingredients that we had. You have the Iraq War, we had Vietnam. And Vietnam was a great organizational tool that was used at that time because there were people pissed off about the war, they was pissed off about racism in this country, they was pissed off about sexism, they was pissed off about a lot of social ills that was not being addressed. And people basically was oppressed and whatnot. When the party came to New York, not just the Black Panther Party, I mean, organizations like the Young Lords Organization, you had white organizations like, there was a white Black Panther Party. I don't know how many people you knew that there was a white Black Panther Party. The White Panthers? Okay, yeah, they were. And they were based in Ann Arbor, Michigan and whatnot. And they were somewhat different than the Black Panther Party, but a lot of the principles that the party stood on, you know, its 10-point program and platform, they had a platform and program that was similar to that, you know. And you had a more progressive organizations in terms of whites, such as SDS, which was one of my favorite organizations because I like their spirit, you know. In the black community, we had to struggle with our daily existence on a real level in terms of being murdered in the streets or being a palmer to your house, your door kicked in and whatnot, you know. It was a lot of Gestapo tactics. The investigative technique during that period of time in terms of the FBI and the CIA and national security, naval intelligence, army intelligence, and Air Force intelligence, all of these intelligence units within the United States government was brought to bear on this social movement. We were somewhat naive, and this is youthfulness, and it's not just for this generation, it's for all generations. You know, we develop unevenly, so to speak. And this is why you have groups like this tonight and other groups to have people come out to attempt to give you a historical overview so you won't feel so isolated, and also try to point out to you why it's very important to make a commitment in your life in terms of struggle and bring about social change. Because if you do not do this, you understand, no matter what your color may be, you will suffer in the United States because it's a capitalist society. You understand? So you have some choices, you know. One of the things, and time won't permit right now, but I really would like to touch bases in terms of white progressive people who choose to struggle and whatnot, you know. Like some of the things, and they're to be admired, many of them, especially coming out of this campus and not too far from here down the street, Columbia University, you know. I mean, they put forth gallant struggles and whatnot, you know. But just as elements from the Black Liberation Movement had uneven development, so did they. Because many of you young white people today, you are the children of those people. And being the children of those people, it means that their lesson hadn't gotten through because your generation, elements in your generation, you know, still exhibit racist tendencies. And this is why racism is a thing that has to always be fought and whatnot. You know, we always should strive to be better human beings. You know, I mean, that's just fundamentally right. People should be about that. When you're not about that, even if you're not a direct hand or involvement in terms of raw oppression, in terms of people being killed in the streets or people not being able to pay their bills or survive or becoming homeless, all these drastic things that happen to us, where society should be in a position to alleviate all of that. With those conditions, brings about organizations such as the Black Panther Party, the Young Lords Organization, the SDS, the Weathermen, and Prairie Fire, and many other groupings that decided that we had to make an attempt and a commitment to bring about a change within the United States. And you are in that position today. You know, you're in that position to do that. The situation is somewhat different in terms of the way it was with us. I mean, it was raw life or death at that time, you know, because they were actually killing people, you know. People were turning up dead and shootouts, and it was a war within the United States, you know, from Fred Hampton to Joanne Little in North Carolina. I mean, many, many countless incidents that went down in this country that was very oppressive and whatnot. And so we had to use different methods to deal with that struggle and whatnot. Where in the Black Panther Party and SNCC, you know, they were like on the front lines during this period in time because of integration and the freedom rides that SNCC was going through. And the Black Panther Party becoming into its own, it was the Black Panther Party for self-defense dealing with defending themselves, literally their bodies, because in Oakland, California, which was noted at that time, one of the racist police organizations in the United States, and they were killing people out there. So I guess it was only you know, fitting that the Black Panther Party would come out of such a situation and turmoil and whatnot. And in terms of our oppression. The party attracted many people, like I said, people, Vietnam veterans, former gang members, a lot of people who was coming out of institutions who had read over the years and who had been locked up during the period of time of Malcolm's existence and even up until Malcolm's death. Those people who were incarcerated between 1960 and 1970, a lot of people who came out of that situation, the prison situation, became involved in our movement. How many people know who Sekou Odinga is? Okay, he came out of such a period in time, you know, like he was a brother out of Queens, was a street brother from a gang member, you understand, who did time for petty crime, became politicized inside the New York State prison system and came back to the streets. and made a commitment to struggle and whatnot. And out of his commitments, you know, his development and his traveling, you know, he was accused of having helped us, help them to liberate us out of Shakur. It's another way of saying that people put our theory into practice, you know. I mean, she was liberated through those efforts and whatnot. When the Black Panther Party came to New York City, as I stated earlier, it had attracted a lot of people. The student movement on the campus within this city was very much afoot. You know, they were taking over buildings at Columbia here at City College. I mean, there was a lot of activism taking place. They could see that they were having an effect and whatnot in terms of the social order of this city at that time, and subsequently the social order of this country. Through the activities of those people who took to the streets, like the march they recently had, when was this past weekend on Iraq?
Yeah.
I can stand here today and attest to you how important that is. And many people, as we said of days of old, you didn't want to get up. I'm not feeling that shit. You know, I got something to do. It's a Saturday or Sunday. You know what I'm saying? I mean, the same thing. I can tell you that brings about results. That brings about serious results, you know. And for those people who want to be involved, you know, there's level of involvement within this struggle, and have always been in most struggles and whatnot. A lot of people came involved in the struggle. They had commitment to schools, their careers, their families, and what they were going to do after that. Some people, there was a lot of dreams deferred.
Sacrifice.
People gave up a lot. I mean, it came to the point that people gave up their lives and whatnot. I happened to come out of an incident where one such person gave up his life, a brother by the name of Ronnie Carter. I'm a former political prisoner also. I don't know if I mentioned that earlier and whatnot. And I come out of the Black Liberation Army. And the Black Liberation Army is basically was the military wing of the Black Panther Party. And it came into being out of COINTELPRO. There was so much oppression brought down during the split. A lot of other things happening. Actually, government finagling, from the CIA to the FBI. And you have probably read in history or read some articles somewhere about how they pitted people against each other, sending letters to this one and doing that to that one. You know, a lot of psychological warfare and whatnot. That's how they learned to control us, or control the movement, I should say, in terms of disruption of the movement, I should say, because they came in to destroy people's liberation movement in this country, you know, and they did that very violently at times, very politically at all times, in the sense of laws, in the sense of having things planted, you know, on people. It wasn't always shootouts and whatnot. Those people that was involved in shootouts, that military wing of the Black Panther Party, that was very few of those. There were very few. The work came out of the Black Panther Party came from the rank and file membership in terms of what we did in terms of our programs, which gave us our political base. Those programs such as free breakfast program, free clothing program, free busing to prison program, you know, sickle cell anemia program, our medical clinics that we ran and whatnot. A lot of times when young people ask about the Black Panther Party, they have a vision of black berets and shotguns and rifles and whatnot. And we were all of that, trust me. We were that. We make no excuse about any of that. You understand? Because we believed at that time, we believe to this day, that people have a basic right to the continued existence on the face of this earth. No one has a right, you understand, to destroy you as an individual or a human being and whatnot, and it becomes much more serious when you start talking about a race of people. And so that's what we were up against, you know. We fought for our continued existence on the face of the fucking earth.
Yeah.
That's what we fought for.
That's right.
And so many of us, you understand, was forced into the situation that we were forced into. As I said, I was a Vietnam veteran in the Black Panther Party. The next thing I know, the counterintelligence program is taking place and whatnot. And because of my experience in the Black Panther Party, and also my experience in the United States military in the Vietnam War and whatnot, I had certain skills that I could bring to another element. And there was a need for that element. So when I talk to people, I don't make no excuses. It was no fucking youthful fantasy. Those of us who took that position, we knew exactly what we were doing and what we were attempting to do. And we fell short on our goals. And what I would like to say to you, if I would leave you for nothing else, is that when you talk to older people such as my age that came out of the movement back then, you put questions to them. You don't want to get off to the glorification of black berets and shotguns and rifles and facing cops and staring them down and shootouts and being successful and whatnot. We were all of that. But ask those people of my generation about the mistakes that was made during that time. That's what I don't hear when people have questions, they don't talk about that. What did y'all fuck up at, man? You know, we know that y'all was all of that. Y'all was that and a couple grits. You know what I'm saying? But like, tell us, you want to know our mistakes, so you won't make those mistakes. And one of the glaring mistakes for me, just for me now, of the Black Panther Party, is that we had an open-door policy in terms of our membership, which allowed for a lot of agent provocateurs and police agents and all kind of people to come in to disrupt such an organization. If you study that point in history and whatnot, you'll devise certain techniques and methods in terms of screening your membership and whatnot, especially if you're going to be on a certain type level. So that was a very important mistake, and that almost doomed many organizations before they even got started. Because there's a lot of organizations that I've forgotten over the years that was attempting to do what we were doing. And they were no better or less, or less, shouldn't be less sung, because they made an attempt. You understand? But we had so many things against us, and philosophically, we knew this. We always talked about being spied upon. Many people that was not in our generation, some that was in our generation, would always take the position that you're just paranoid. You know, you just seeing people that's not there. And when everything was said and done, they were there.
You know, they was the ones.
They were there, you know. And they caused a lot of damage, you know. A lot of people that come out of my period in history in terms of struggling in this country, you understand? Some of them are in mental institutions today. Some of them were destroyed. Those that were semi-functional created families that became dysfunctional. That's the type of effect that it had on us, you know. And what I had deviated from back to family is what I was saying, and I went on to something else, and that is that the young progressive whites that's here today, your age bracket, your maybe, just maybe not always the case, but your parents were probably progressive. Or there were element of people progressive at that period in time. Their job was not completed either. Their job, because we see like racist organizations sprouting up in the Midwest and whatnot, and sprouting and doing things that they were doing 40, 50 years ago. You know, Klan, this kid that was beat to death in Nebraska, the gay person. Situations like that was taking place, which was equivalent to the Emmett Till's and black people's period in time, you know. And so those incidents motivate us to struggle. In close, let me just say this. My experience in my life and my involvement and whatnot, and as I said, from Vietnam to the Black Liberation Army to the Black Panther Party to the overall civil rights movement at that period in time, there's so much that I would like to give to you. And it may come across disjointed at this point in time and whatnot, you know. But there's so much, and you can get this from other people of my generation. When you have political people come before you and they speak and whatnot, you know, ask them pertinent questions, because that's going to help you. Technology have developed in this country to the extent that it was not like that when we came along, in terms of computers and all the other things that's taking place, in terms of how they track people and how they eavesdrop on you, how they set up conspiracies. They've had 20, 30, 40 years to practice on this, you understand? And so, like, try and get from my generation the things that curtail us. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Neil Silvers, who's a board member of the Black Panther Party and also of the Young Lords. She's also now an activist with 1199 and also a member of the Workers to Free Bumia, an organization that stands for the absolute freedom of Bumia, with no slogans of new trials or anything, just absolute freedom. So,
how you doing? The job that we have is a difficult one, to try to give you a historical perspective of what it was like in the Black Panther Party on the one hand, and at the same time to give you a sense of what it is that we have to do now and how to go forward. So what I want to do is a couple of things. I want to show you that what was going on in the Black Panther Party in terms of the repression from the government, which was part of the reason for our demise in the end, was occurring then. And I would like for anybody who is a member of a criminal justice or a surveillance organization, just raise your hand and let us know you're in the room. We don't have any. Oh, there's one.
There's one.
One in the back.
Or was you asking a question?
Or she want to
ask? You got stuck between stop and go?
No, that's, she may be. Who knows? But anyway, they are here. Very quickly, what I'm getting ready to read to you is from a book called The COINTELPRO Papers. Get yourself a copy of it. It was written by Ward Churchill and Jim Vanderwall. And this is documents from the FBI's secret war against dissidents in the United States. Okay, so this is real. That are actual real documents. You can take a look at them. They're actual faxes. And I just want to say that over the first years of its official anti-black COINTELPRO, the FBI developed a network of 4,000 members assembled from what had previously been called TOPLEV, Top Level Black Community Leadership Program, and the Black Pro Program. And that purpose of this, the goals of this program for maximum effectiveness, this is actually written by the FBI, by J. Edgar Hoover. The goals of this program for maximum effectiveness of the COINTELPRO program and to prevent wasted effort, long-range goals are set. Number one, the goal is to prevent the coalition of militant black nationalist organizations. In unity, there is strength, they say. A truism that is no less valid for all of its triteness. An effective coalition of black nationalist groups might be the first step toward a real Mau Mau in America, the beginning of a true black revolution. This is what they're writing. So it wasn't us writing this. This is them. And everybody knows what the Mau Mau's were?
No.
If you don't, could you explain the Mau Mau's, please, brother, in the back?
The King of the Land of Freedom Army that fought a liberation war against the British back in the 50s.
Thank you. In Africa. He said it was the freedom liberation in the 50s. Okay. The next goal was to prevent the rise of a quote-unquote messiah who could unify and electrify the black militant nationalist movement. Malcolm X might have been such a messiah. He is a martyr of the movement today. Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael, and Elijah Muhammad all aspired to this position, etc., etc. Okay, number three, to prevent violence of black nationalist groups. Well, number four is to prevent militant black national groups and leaders from gaining respectability by discrediting them to three separate segments of the community. The goal of discrediting black nationalists should be handled tactically in three ways. You must discredit these groups and individuals first to the responsible Negro community. Second, they must be discredited to the white community, both the responsible community and to the quote-unquote liberals, who have vestiges of sympathy for militant black nationalists simply because they are Negroes. And third, these groups must be discredited in the eyes of Negro radicals and followers of the movement. This last area requires an entirely different tactic from the first two. Publicity about violent tendencies and radical statements merely enhance black nationalists to the groups, and it adds respectability in a different way. And then they go on with what their goals are. So that was the goal of the government, and that continues to be the goal of the government with any group of people who is actively involved in making changes in our society. So be clear about that issue, and that they did it in very many ways that Blood talked about and that Shah talked about, but they're doing it in other ways. They have more sophisticated ways to do that today. But I'm actually supposed to talk to you a little bit about my history and how I got into the movement. I came to New York City at the age of 18 years old as a VISTA volunteer. I was a working class youth, dark-skinned African-American sister who couldn't get into a sorority because I was too dark-skinned and didn't want to go to college because I didn't want to be in the college social scene unless I was in a sorority. So I decided I was going to do something else. And that was become a VISTA volunteer and see the world, which is how it was at that time. I was assigned to New York City. I was trained in Baltimore as a community organizer, assigned to New York City to the South Bronx. So that was in 1966, 67. The work that I did in the South Bronx brought me to understand that the system was set up essentially to oppress and exploit poor people, people of color, working people. Now, how did that happen? That happened because I tried very hard to work inside the system. I tried in every way. And it was completely impossible because the system was essentially set up. I did everything that I could. and the system showed itself to not be willing to make the necessary changes for people to live a decent life, which is essentially all we're talking about. We want everyone to have the opportunity to live, have a decent life. And that was definitely not what the system was set up to do. So I left VISTA and became a worker at Lincoln Hospital Mental Health Center. And within 2 weeks of my getting a job at Lincoln Hospital, the workers, because of the conditions of the community, of mental health in the community, and that mental health in the community was based on the horrible social conditions, horrible housing, health care, education, police brutality, incarceration of the youth, all this, people were having tremendous psychological problems. And the workers in the mental health services decided that they had to make some changes. They had to do something about it. And what they did was they took over and seized the administration of Lincoln Hospital and ran the hospital for about approximately 30 days. And that's the truth. In that process of running the hospital and developing a collective leadership and including the community, because the community was also involved, the patients were involved, the nurses were involved, this was a huge project. We also needed the support of activists in the community. And who came to our aid? The Black Panther Party. And that Black Panther Party was a major organization that aided the workers in its maintenance of the takeover of Lincoln Hospital. And they did a tremendous job. And in that process, that's how I was recruited into the Black Panther Party. I think that my major reason for joining the Black Panther Party was that I knew that they supported the struggles of the community with their lives. And that these were courageous young men and women who were willing to put their lives on the line and who were willing to take it to the streets. I'll give you an example of the other kinds of things that the Black Panthers were doing. We did things like supporting the struggle of the parents in the South Bronx and Harlem in regard to the low quality of the food that was being served to our kids in the lunchroom. Not only did we, of course, run a free breakfast program, but the quality of the lunches in the South Bronx and Harlem was that they used to serve green meat, sour milk, all kind of low quality food to our kids. So we worked with an organization called United Bronx Parents. United Bronx Parents one night called the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords together, and they said, we got to take an action at the Board of Education. This is when it was still a Board of Education. We went around to three or four different schools, gathered up the food that they were serving to our children. We gathered up that green milk, that green meat, and that stale bread, and that sour milk. We put it in black plastic bags, and we put it on a little truck, and we all drove down to the Board of Education meeting. And what we did with that, the Board of Education at that time used to meet in a huge room, and used to have a well in the room, and the board would sit around the well. And we took our bags of this food. Actually, the parents didn't do it. It was the Black Panther Party that did it. Took those bags, opened them up, and poured them all over there so the people could see. That's actually it. So that's the kind of activity. Now, you want to talk about what the Black Panther Party did for the community. Housing was a horrendous problem. And so there were rats eating up kids. We did a lot of organizing around housing, particularly in the South Bronx. The rats were biting on the children and jumping into the cribs and all that stuff. So the Black Panthers were really some amazing characters. They said, well, we should get some of these rats and take them, let some of the other people feel what it's like to have rats on them. So that's what we did. We collected rats and put them in jars, these big old rats. Put them in jars and, you know, put them in a plastic bag. And along with the housing organization in the community, went to the city council and let the rats out in the city council meeting. You have an impact on the lives of people. You take real things and make real things happen. It's about truth. It's about reality. And it's about making sure that the truth is clear in the minds and the hearts of the people in the community and those people who may have an opportunity or who may be in a position to make some change and to help make that change. But that's not the people who make the change. The people who make the change are the ones who suffer, who are the victims. But anyway, I wanted to go on because I want to make sure that our question and answer period is very long and that our dialogue is a really wonderful one and really dynamic one. The role of women, that's what I'm supposed to talk about. I really want to talk about this. It would be great if I could say that the role that women played was an equal role. But because of the conditions in our society, all of you women know that even though we might be just as strong, just as bright, just as militant as the brothers, the truth is that we don't get an opportunity, we haven't gotten an opportunity to be at the same levels of leadership in our organizations. That's one of the struggles that was waged internally in our movement in general, in the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords Party. That struggle was a central part of our everyday activities. The sisters worked very hard. And as a matter of fact, the core of the grind, day-to-day work, we did not only that, we took care of the kids, not only that, we cooked, not only that, we cleaned, not only that, we sold the newspapers on the street. We did everything that the brothers did, plus more. And not only that, I have to just say that I was a green belt in karate and was just as able to defend myself as any of the brothers in the Black Panther Party, and many of the women were. And that's really the truth. So the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords Party and the organizations, all of the militant organizations during that time, really worked on struggling to include the equality of women and the change of each individual human being. Because the idea was to change the society, but in the process of changing society, it was to change yourself. That's the issue that I think we're missing sometimes in understanding. In order to become a collectivist, that means you have to make changes in the way you function in society. In order to have trust, because in order to do this struggle, you gotta trust each other. In order to have that kind of trust, because when you're in that kind of situation, my life was in their hands and their lives were in my hands. In order to have that kind of trust, you gotta change your life. You gotta change what you do. You gotta change how you think. You got to change how you interact with each other. That's the key to it. It's changing how you interact with your fellow human beings. Because why are you doing this? You're doing this to make change in society. And the whole purpose of this is to let us understand that the reason why we got a problem in our society is that human beings don't see other human beings as human beings. So if that's basic, and we got to start figuring out how to be human beings ourselves and how to see other human beings as human beings. And if you don't want something to happen to yourself, then why would you stand by and allow it to happen to another human being? That's the fundamental question about who we are as human beings. This is what women brought to the movement. The sensitivity to understand this whole question. Because we are responsible for the new generations that come up, for the babies that come up. And we have to be able to teach this. And in some ways, the whole issue of nurturance becomes a key to what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And the brothers really have to work to open up yourselves to get with this. Because Black Panther women always had it. Breakthrough changes in the society. And I want to talk about what those breakthrough changes were. Healthcare is a right. Healthcare is a right of all human beings. It was a right in 1966. It was a right in 1967, it was a right in 1968 when we were struggling for health care as a right in New York City, and it is a right today. That's a major breakthrough change that we brought. Bringing sickle cell anemia to the fore as being one of the most serious diseases in our society, and even more now because there are more people of color in the society today than there were then. So that question of sickle cell anemia, its impact, the work that's being done, whether or not people are receiving the proper care for sickle cell anemia. Nutrition for children. Well, it's very clear that the Black Panther Party put on the table the need for breakfasts for children and lunches for free lunches and breakfasts for children. And the fact that you can't be educated well if you're not nutritionally sound. And that was our reasoning, and it was such an important impact on society that the government eventually took it over and fucked it up. But they took it over because they recognized the importance of what we were laying on the table. We did that. The need for a decent education that includes the impact of other communities besides just the white Anglo-Saxons, okay? Now, one of the things that's so interesting to me, and the brother said this too, and I want to place some emphasis on that, and that is that militancy on the campus is the only way that you're able to maintain the things that we have gained. We gained a lot, But if you are not militant, if you're not conscious of what your history is as a campus organization, as a group of youth, as a group of students, they will slowly retract everything that we fought for. You have to have a commitment to maintaining what you have, or else they're going to take it back. The question of a trial by a jury of your peers. Another one of the points of our 10-point platform or program of the Black Panther Party, and this is still an issue. Mumia Abu-Jamal in 1982 did not have a jury of his peers, okay? He did not have a jury of his peers, and that was conscious, that they tried to make sure, in other words, they actually educated themselves and other people as to how not to have people of color, African Americans, on the jury. I want to leave lots of time on it. I have a lot of things to say, a lot to talk about in terms of the progressive and leadership role the Black Panther Party played. But I want to talk to you about what I see as the major issues today. International struggles and the war is a key issue for you. Because as long as they're spending all that money to wage war, then we are losing health care money, we are losing education money, we are losing money for decent housing. We have a real big problem, and we are losing further and further on one major issue that you absolutely have to consider and think about and do something about, and that is, how could it be that in New York City, 50% of black males are unemployed? This is unbelievable. This is a question that's got to be taken up. There's no way in the world that there should be 50% unemployment of anybody. But of black males in New York City, we have to do something about that. And we have to do it now. We have to do it quickly. Because that's the black males that are left on the street after the 25% are incarcerated. So what are we doing to our black men in our society? That's a genocidal attack on black men. This is an issue that we really have to take up. Prisons and the thousands of people, the millions of people that are in prison, but we can talk about that later. Intimidation of workers, people that struggle for change, that's us. All of you, that's a major question. We have to work on these issues. How is it that we fight back? And how is it that we maintain our organizations and continue to build and continue to struggle without being intimidated? Because that's very difficult. They spend their lives trying to intimidate you, and they spend all a lot of work. If you think this was a lot of work for them to do, they're doing a lot more now than they were doing then. Okay. Unemployment, health care. One other major thing, I'm going to let you go. But I just want to tell you, study, study, study. Read everything you can read. Talk to everybody you can talk to. Get the facts. Don't listen to the yang yang. Get the real facts about what really happened and about what the conditions really are in society. Have an analysis of what the conditions are so that you can move against those conditions in a concrete way, in a way that makes sense to you and to the people that you're working with and the people that you're working for. Absolutely have to do this. Be thoughtful. Stay unified. Because that's the issue, and it's been the issue for us continually, that is so easy to ego trip. You know, it is so easy to think that you're the only somebody. It's not about individuals, because what happens is they kill our leaders and our movements fall apart. So it can't be about individuals. It has to be about groups of individuals. It has to be about united leadership. It has to be about panels of leadership of people that have different skills. And some people, they talk. Yeah, good talking skills. That's good. Keep them. Some people got theoretical skills. Good. Let's work together. You keep them. But there's one individual as the only leader. One individual can never do everything. So you don't want to have a one individual leadership organization. You want to have team leadership organizations. You want to build teams of leaders. Study, organize, and you needed organs. You need blogs. I was getting ready to say newspapers. No, not anymore. You need blogs. You need, you know what I'm saying? You need ways to disseminate information widely, and you need ways to communicate with each other. Students in Hawaii that just seized the administration building, that's what we're talking about. You have to be in contact with them. You have to let them know you support them. And you have to be a part of that struggle. And that means that you have all the technology that's possible. You can email them and shit. You know, I know they got a website and shit. You know what I'm saying? Get with that. Get with that. I know that we have lots of time to talk to each other, but I just wanted to say those few things and move on.
All right. And our next and final speaker is a prominent member of the campaign to end the death penalty and also a former death row prisoner from California. Let's hear it for Shuja Graham.
I'm really nervous because the first time I've got able to speak with my elders. And then my elders were like, then the Corona chapter of the Black Panther Party, Yasmin, stand-up sister, and BJ, who come in tonight, that is here. And I appreciate you all for being here and coming out and representing the spirit of the past, and not only the spirit of the past, but the spirit of the present. So I want to thank you all. And to members of the campaign and socialist revolutionaries and all those who have been involved in the movement over our years. So much has happened and so much has went on, but still we stand. Somewhere I read that we are all caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in one single garment of destiny. What affects one directly affects us all indirectly. So as I stand tonight wounded by the blows of capital punishment and racism, I do not stand alone. We have all been wounded by the blows of racism and capital punishment, wounded by not slain, so we fight on today in that particular spirit. Who am I? Shuja Graham. Former condemned man, grew up in the South, persecuted by racism, grew up under segregation. Segregation affected my life so profoundly that I'll never forget. But not only will I never forget, but never will I forget again how to stand strong and stand up for what is right. I come from a little small southern town called Lake Providence, Louisiana. Growing up under segregation and seeing my parents work every day of their lives and still accomplish nothing in the end. At times I thought there was something wrong with my mother and father. I figured they couldn't work hard enough to earn a living. But later on in my life, as I left Lake Providence in Louisiana at 11 years old, I come to South Central Los Angeles, and I met a new spirit, a spirit of the new militancy. And that was the spirit not only of the Civil Rights Movement, but the spirit of the Black Panther Party. Men and women who are willing to stand up with righteous indignation and fight against the blows of racism and police brutality without regret. Those are the ones who inspired my life. As I was just a young militant growing up in that movement and who was associated with that past, I went on to prison and I met the spirit of George Jackson, the prison movement, the field marshal of the Black Panther Party. No one would have probably ever knew the name of George Jackson if it wasn't for 1970. There's always something that inspires our movement, and is always a catastrophic disaster. In the history of my life, that catastrophic disaster happened in 1970. I was a young man, 19 years old. Exercise yards was open in Soledad State Prison. Three prominent leaders of our movement was put on exercise yard with three whites. Three shots was fired. All three blacks was killed. One white got hit by a ricochet bullet. They declared it justifiable homicide. I couldn't read or write, but as a little boy, I knew what justifiable homicide meant, because I'd heard it so many times in our community. It meant the murder of a noble, innocent African by the forces of racism and evilness. I wish I could offer you tonight a solution, that is some mystical force in the air that will come down in the course of time that will heal all this evilness and injustice. It ain't but one force, and that's you. Men and women of every race uniting together, fighting for a common cause, fighting for a common humanity. That is the fight that has been in my life. My life has been dedicated to this movement since I was 18. I didn't have to go to death row. If I would have talked and told them what they wanted to hear, I didn't have to go. But I refused to compromise. Some told me to play crazy. Some told me to do many things. But I said, if I do all those things, all the things that the ones that have made the supreme sacrifice in the name of their movement and what I've stood up and suffered for would all go in vain. So I chose to fight until the end. And I ended up on California death row. There was old saying in this struggle. The race is not always given to the swift or the strong, but to those who can endure until the end. I can't promise you in the end how well I'll fight, but I can promise you one thing. I'll be with you until the end of the time. And you can take that to the bank. In 1970, after W.L. Nolan was assassinated, you heard the story of George Jackson, the Soledad 3. You heard the story of the Soledad 7. These are all cases that rose out of the fact that W.L. was killed. Young black Africans in the prison system decided that they wasn't going to fall anymore to the collective blows of racism. They decided to unite and stand up. And some of us chose different paths on how to deal with that. But we was able as a political entity. I was involved in the prison movement. And by the way, I was raised. Everything that I know tonight and tell you, I was raised by a prisoner who never had a chance. He took me on his wings and he taught me things that he couldn't do himself. But he always said, this is the right thing to do. He told me about how a prison has corrupted him that he could no longer maintain. But he still seen a greater spirit in me to do the things that he know that he couldn't do. And he invested a lot of time in me. And from that day on, I never looked back. That's why the most tragic day in my life, November 27, 21 years old, militant bound, thinking about taking on the burden and responsibility to the whole world, although we was in prison. Because as a consequence of the Black Panther Party and all the Black Panthers start coming to jail, they continued that fight. They politicized us. They took us from an arrogant militancy to a revolutionary consciousness. And George talked about revolutionary internationalism. And we took it to another level. And we kept evolving as an entity. And in November the 27th, as I became more committed and more dedicated, I was accused of a murder assault on a prison guard and I was facing death in California. And at that time in 1973, I'm gonna show you the conspiracy. They didn't even have a death penalty in California when I went to death row. It had been abolished. Why did a young man can't read or write is facing capital punishment there? You tell me. It was a conspiracy, not because we was criminal, because we was political and fighting for the dignity of our humanity and the humanity of the world. That's what we was about. That's what Jacksonism was about. I went and endured four long trials. My first trial ended in a hung jury. When they talk about racism and systematic exclusion of African Americans off the jury, that was my plan. That was my situation. We weren't allowed to have peoples of color on our jury. Because of the racism in our case, how the Nazis came in and paraded and made all the derogatory statements, they figured that would turn African Americans off. So the DA, the prosecutor, made it his paramount concern to systematically ask them trivial questions. Although they was associated with law enforcement and some of them fathers or whatever was judges. But they was wrong color. And then we was convicted on the second trial and I went to death row for 4 years and I can remember as though it was yesterday. And I remember the day that they sentenced me in. More than anything, it kind of, after fighting so long, and I didn't take it real hard, but it kind of hurt my feelings for to see this Klansmen set up here in this robe and declared me as unfit to live, and they sentenced me to die December the 8th. And I remember going up to San Quentin I had been in prison almost 6 years when I went to death row, and I thought I had seen it all. But the way they beat me down, how they talked about it, had been waiting on me since 1973. I speak up. I said they had been waiting on me since 1973 when I come up there in 76. All the goonies. I said, nigga, we've been waiting on you for 4 long years. He said, you've been fighting a good fight and talking a good talk. He said, what you have to say now? They all surrounded us. First, they beat my co-defender down. I had to sit there and watch. Psychological torture. I'm in handcuffs. And I see them beating him down. He's 5'5" at the most. Weighed 160 pounds. And I see all these goonies attack him. Then it was my turn. They beat me down. Then after they took me up the elevator to death row, they pretended that they didn't know the way to my cell, and they took me to show me like where the chair were. And I refused to move because I know where I were. And they said, oh, this nigga know everything. So they took me to my proper floor. They stripped me naked. About 15 of them walked in on me. And they told me, what you want to do now? Who are you? And you know what I told them? In the midst of all of it, and this is in my court's transcripts, I said, I'm a Jacksonist, and I'm going to be a Jacksonist, and I'm going to be a socialist, and I'm going to be a revolutionary, and until the day I die, now do what you have to do. We've been talking too long, so I'm going to have to close to my elders. You know, they love to talk, and I appreciate them, but no. Because we got other things to do. We got to know how to whoop these people and push them back. See, because I'm getting old, and I need room for my wheelchair, so I want y'all to let me have some room so I can keep on fighting. But it came a time. All the sacrifices that I made and the statements that I made when they sentenced me to death, it would mobilize human beings to come and form a defense committee. It was young children that were 15 and 16 years old that were skipping school that came to attend my trial. And when I went to death row, they stood up and formed a defense committee. And that's why I'm here today, not because of the system, but in spite of the system. I'm here because individuals like yourself took the time to discipline themselves and unite as an organized political entity and fight against the forces of injustice. That's why I'm here today. It's not because of some federal government sent something out or some people in office felt sympathy for me. They have never felt sympathy for me. But I've evolved. I feel sympathy for them. At one time, I was hating. But as King said, I can't afford to hate. I got to love everybody. But I ain't got to like now, son of a whoever. You feel me? That's where I'm coming from tonight. So my brothers and sisters, as I went through a third trial, and it ended in a hung jury. Make a long story short, I had a fourth trial. NWACP and all organizations got behind us and tried to stop the fourth trial, but no one could stop it. But it was, in the end, my case was overturned on the systematic exclusion of African Americans. Make a long story short, in my third and fourth trial, there was no African Americans. We had a hung jury in the third trial, and we was fortunate enough to pick 12 fair European that was able to be objective and judge our cases on the merits. And we was acquitted. And I walked out after never thinking I would get out of prison. I had became institutionalized. I didn't think about getting out, and I just kind of gave up in so many ways of just sacrificing my life to help the other prisoners. And that's just why I struggle today to try to continue to be a voice for those who are afraid to speak. Movement for those who are stuck. When I close, I would like to close with a word that I used to former death row person left with me that I went to South Carolina and fought for 10 days to try to save his life. I never met him, and I never knew him. And his death still affects me today. That's what I talk about, the interconnection. But he left us with a statement that really touched me, and I try to carry on his spirit through that. I don't remember it all, but I remember the words that touched me. And he talked about peoples. And he talked about the most happiest of peoples don't necessarily have the best of everything. They just make the most out of what comes their way. Happiness comes to those who hurt, those who have struggled, and those who have tried. For only they can appreciate the importance of those who have touched their life. We can't go on well in life until we overcome our past failures, disappointments, and heartaches. The most brightest of futures would always be based on a forgotten or forgiven path. When you were born, my sister, everyone around you were probably crying, was probably smiling, and you were crying. Go on out and live your life so that when you die, you'll be the one that is smiling and everyone around you will be crying. Long live the spirit of our struggle. Long live internationalism. Fight to save humanity. Do what you can. If there's nothing that you leave here with tonight, if you can leave with anything, leave with a commitment. Find an issue, a final movement that you will commit yourself to and serve. Service is the way to righteousness. It's not how well you do, but how hard you fight for the interests of us all. Thank you all for having me here.